Hello, 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 freaks, geeks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome to another episode of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. I don't have much going on in my personal life today to report on, and there's not much going on in the world of horror, except that Stephen King has just finished writing a novel about Holly Gibney, who some people who are into Stephen King novels might recognize as being a character from Mr. Mercedes and The Outsider. And that NECA is coming out with Evil Dead 40th Anniversary Ash Williams figure, which I'm actually pretty excited about since I'm a big NECA collector. And I have a bunch of shit from them that I probably shouldn't have bought that cost me a lot of money. But who knows? Maybe one day they'll actually be worth me fucking buying. So I'm definitely holding on to those. And one other thing that's kind of interesting in the world of horror is that Reanimator is coming to the Full Moon streaming service, which if you don't have and are a fan of the Full Moon movies, it's you have to pay to be able to stream things on it. It's only like fucking $5 a month, I think, if that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's $5. I forget what I pay. But anyway, like I said, Reanimator is coming to the Full Moon streaming service, and there's going to be an hour-long reunion special included with it, so that might actually be pretty interesting to watch, if you're a fan of the movie. I also forgot to mention, I also have a new album out. It's called The Darkest Corner of the Mind. It's kind of a return to my electronic roots, so if you were into my music back then, it's definitely one for you to check out. And like always, you can check it out on Spotify and all other major streaming platforms. So anyway, this week, I decided that I would talk about one of the most, a franchise that has probably one of the most iconic films ever in it. I'm not too sure how iconic the rest of the movies are. But the first Psycho is, without a doubt, one of the most iconic slasher, and I kind of hesitate to call it a slasher, but I guess it is a slasher. But anyway, it's one of the most iconic slasher films ever. So I thought I would talk about the entire franchise this episode. And for those who aren't aware, yes, Psycho is actually a franchise with more than one movie. So let's get right into it with 1960s Psycho.
Quiet little motel, when in fact it has now become known as the scene of the crime.
Do you have a vacancy?
Oh, we have 12 vacancies.
You know, this is the first place that looks like it's hiding from the world.
I think that we're all in our private traps, clamped in them. And none of us can ever get out.
Is anyone at home? Oh, that must be my mother.
Is anything wrong?
Am I acting as if there's something wrong?
She's not missing so much as she's run away.
Put me down! Mother! Oh, God! Mother!
What are you running away from?
She looked like a wrong one to you.
It's not as if she were a maniac. She just goes a little mad sometimes.
She wouldn't even harm a fly.
After spending a Friday afternoon fucking in a Phoenix hotel, real estate secretary Marion Crane and her boyfriend Sam Loomis discuss their inability to get married because of Sam's debts. Marion returns to work, steals a cash payment of $400,000 back then, which was a lot of money, entrusted to her for deposit, and sets off to drive to Sam's home in Fairville, California. En route, Marion hurriedly trades her car, arousing suspicion from both the car dealer and the California Highway Patrol officer. Marion then stops for the night at the Bates Motel, located off the main highway, and hides the stolen money inside a newspaper. The owner, Norman Bates, descends from a large house overlooking the motel, registers Marion under an assumed name, and invites her to dine with him. After Norman returns to his house, Marion overhears Norman arguing with his mother about Marion's presence. Norman then returns with a light meal and apologizes for his mother's outburst. Norman then discusses his hobby as a taxidermist, his mother's illness, and how people have a private trap they want to escape. Marion decides to drive back to Phoenix in the morning and return the stolen money. However, as Marion showers, a shadowy figure appears and stabs her to death. Soon afterward, Norman's anguished voice is heard from the house yelling, "Mother! Oh God! Mother! Blood! Blood!" Norman then cleans up the murder scene, puts Marion's body, belongings, and the hidden cash in her car, and drives it into a swamp. Sometime later, Marion's sister Lila arrives in Fairvale a week later, tells Sam about the theft, and demands to know her whereabouts. He denies knowing anything about her disappearance, and a private investigator named Arbogast approaches them, saying that he has been hired to retrieve the money. Arbogast stops at the Bates Motel and questions Norman, whose nervous behavior and inconsistent answers arouse his suspicion. He examines the guest register and discovers from her handwriting that Marion did indeed spend the night at the motel. And Arbogast learns that Marion had spoken to Norman's mother. Arbogast asks to speak to her, but Norman refuses to allow it. Arbogast then updates Sam and Lila about his search and promises to phone again in an hour. After he enters the Bates home in search of Norman's mother, a shadowy figure once again emerges from the bedroom and stabs him to death. Lila and Sam do not hear from Arbogast. Sam visits the motel, and he sees a figure in the house whom he assumes is Norman's mother. Lila and Sam alert the local sheriff, who then tells them that Norman's mother died in a murder-suicide 10 years earlier. The sheriff suggests that Arbogast lied to Sam and Lila so he could pursue Marion and the money, and convinced that something happened to Arbogast, Lila and Sam drive to the motel. Sam distracts Norman in the office, while Lila sneaks into the house, but suspicious, Norman becomes agitated and knocks Sam unconscious. As he goes to the house, Lila hides in the fruit cellar, where she discovers Norman's mother's mummified body. She screams, and Norman, wearing his mother's clothes and a wig, enters the cellar and tries to stab her. Sam then appears and subdues him. At the police station, a psychiatrist explains that a jealous Norman murdered his mother and her lover 10 years earlier. Norman then mummified his mother's corpse and began treating it as if she were still alive. He recreated his mother in his mind as an alternate personality, as jealous and possessive towards Norman as he felt about his mother. When Norman is attracted to a woman, mother takes over, and he had murdered two other young women before Marion, and Arbogast was killed to hide his mother's crime. The psychiatrist concludes that mother has now completely taken over Norman's personality, and movie ends with Norman sitting in a jail cell and hears his mother saying that the murders were all his doing, and Marion's car is retrieved from the swamp. This is perhaps one of director Alfred Hitchcock's best known movies, and although it wasn't at the time, it is now considered to be his best film. And in 1992, the Library of Congress deemed the film culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant and selected it for preservation in the United States National Film Registry. This is a huge, huge movie. It wasn't so much when it was first released back in the 60s, but it slowly gained momentum and became the hit we know it as today. I mean, it was something that was pretty much not seen or done before this movie. And if nobody who listens to this has ever seen it, then I suggest that you stop fucking listening to me babble on right now and go watch it and then return to listen to the rest of this podcast. All the actors do good. And Janet Leigh, who is Jamie Lee Curtis's mother, and as, of course, everybody knows her, or Jamie Lee, I mean, as the heroine, Jamie Strode, in the first two Halloween movies, and the several sequels that would follow. If you want to hear about those, just go listen to past past episodes, because I'm not going to get into that right now. But as I was saying, this is rightfully a classic. And even though it's kind of outdated by today's standards when it comes to shock and horror, it's still a very good watch, and I highly recommend it. This had a budget of $806,947 and brought in $50 million at the box office. IMDb gave it an 8.5 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes at 96%, Letterboxd a 4 out of 5, and I give it a 4.5 out of 5. And that leads us to the first sequel, 1983's Psycho 2.
I have a petition here signed by 743 people against Norman Bates' release.
Madam, please sit down. This matter is being represented by the district attorney.
Norman was not convicted of murder. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity.
Don't you realize they're going to release a homicidal maniac?
I'll ask you to sit down, Mrs. Loomis.
It's all too obvious. Our courts protect the criminals, not their victims.
Norman Bates is judged, restored to sanity, and is ordered released forthwith.
It's 22 years later, and Norman Bates is coming home.
I own a motel not too far from here, and you'd be welcome to spend the night in one of the empty rooms if you'd like.
Good night, Mary.
And he's back in business.
Who is this? My mother is dead.
I'm telling you, there was a note on that wheel from my dead mother.
Norman, it couldn't be your mother. It had to be someone else.
I trust her. She would never do anything to hurt me. No. She'll kill you. I know she will.
Look out behind you!
No, I won't do that. You can't make me kill her.
22 years later, Norman Bates is home.
Taking place 22 years after the events of the first film, Norman Bates has overcome his delusions and accepted that his mother is dead. Having never been convicted of murder, instead being found not guilty by insanity, Bates is released from a mental institution by the court after being deemed mentally sound. Marion Crane's sister Lila, the widow of Marion's former lover Sam Loomis, vehemently protests Norman's release, but her plea is dismissed. Against the advice of Dr. Bill Raymond, Norman takes up residence in his old home behind the Bates Motel. He reports to a prearranged job at a nearby diner where a woman named Emma Spool works. After work, a young waitress at the diner, Mary Samuels, has been thrown out of her boyfriend's place, and Norman offers to let her stay at the motel, then extends the offer to his home when he discovers that the motel's new manager, Warren Toomey, has been using the motel to deal drugs, and he immediately fires Toomey. Norman's assimilation into society appears to be going well until he begins to receive mysterious phone calls and notes from Mother at the house and diner. During a work shift, a drunk Toomey decides to pick a fight with Norman, who suspects him of leaving the messages. Shortly after, a figure in a black dress stabs Toomey to death as he is packing to leave the motel. Becoming increasingly sympathetic to and impressed by Norman's fight to keep his sanity, Mary takes up permanent residence in a guest room at his house. Later on, while Norman is renovating the motel, he hears voices in the house and enters his mother's bedroom to find it exactly as it was 22 years ago. A sound lures him to the attic, where he is locked inside. Meanwhile, a teenage couple sneaks in through the cellar window to go fuck. They notice a female figure pacing in the next room, and as they try to climb out, the boy is stabbed to death. The girl escapes and alerts the police, and Mary finds Norman in the attic, and he shows her his mother's bedroom, only to find it back to its state of disuse. The sheriff then arrives and questions them about the boy's murder, and Mary claims they were out walking together at the time. After the sheriff leaves, Norman rebukes her for lying, and he fears that he himself may have killed the boy, since Mary told him the attic was unlocked when she found him. That evening, Mary and Norman find a bloody rag stuffed in the toilet. Norman is horrified, believing he has committed another murder, but Mary insists that he is innocent. Mary then goes down to check the motel, and in the parlor, she is surprised by Lila, her mother. Lila and Mary have in fact been making the phone calls and notes, even posing at the window dressed as Norman's mother. Mary altered his mother's bedroom and locked Norman in the attic so she could change it back, and all of this was an attempt to drive Norman insane again and have him recommitted. However, Mary's growing friendship with Norman has convinced her he is no longer capable of killing. She, however, suspects someone else is in the house, pointing out that Norman was locked in the attic at the time of the boy's death. Later, Norman becomes terrified to leave his room, saying he saw his real mother in the house, and Mary admits to Norman that his sanity is beginning to erode and stays to comfort him. Dr. Raymond then discovers Mary's identity as Lila's daughter and tells Norman that the two of them must be the ones harassing him. He also has the corpse of Norman's mother exhumed, just to prove to Norman that he's not being haunted by his mother. Norman is only partially convinced, saying the one behind everything must be his real mother, despite there being no record of him being adopted. Norman then confronts Mary with what Dr. Raymond told him, and she says that she has given up her part in Lila's ruse, but Lila will not stop. While Lila is retrieving her mother costume from the cellar, a figure steps out of the shadows and murders her. Meanwhile, the police dredge the swamp and find a car with Toomey's body in the trunk. Mary runs to the house to try to convince Norman to flee, and Norman answers the phone and starts speaking to Mother. Mary listens in, but nobody is on the line with Norman. While Norman debates with Mother about her command to kill Mary, she runs into the cellar and dresses up as Mother, complete with butcher knife, in an unsuccessful bid to get Norman to hang up. Dr. Raymond then foolishly grabs her from behind, thinking he has caught her in the act of trying to drive Norman insane, and in her fight, Mary accidentally turns and plunges the butcher knife into his heart. Confronted by the sight of Mother standing over Dr. Raymond's bloody corpse, Norman's sanity finally snaps and he starts to come after Mary, babbling. Mary then backs into the fruit cellar and tries to protect herself from the advancing Norman. She then stumbles upon Lila's body, buried in a pile of coal, and assuming Norman is responsible, Mary raises her knife to kill him, but is shot dead by the incoming police. The ensuing investigation is inconclusive, but in light of an overheard argument between Mary and Lila, Mary's attempt to kill Norman, and her dressing as his mother, the police incorrectly determine that Mary most likely committed all the murders. Later, Emma visits Norman and informs him that she is his real mother, and that Mrs. Bates was her sister, who adopted Norman as an infant while Emma was institutionalized. She reveals that she was a real murderer, having killed anybody who tried to harm her son, and in response, Norman strikes her in the head with a shovel, killing her. He then carries the body upstairs to Mother's room, and begins talking to himself in her voice, signifying that Norman's mother's personality has once again taken control of his mind, and the movie ends. It would be easy to say that this first sequel falls into all the cliches that you can think of when it comes to a slasher film. And numerous things could be used to avoid this sequel altogether. However, this is actually a really good, worthy, and underrated sequel, which brings perfect homage to the Master of Suspense's best film, and of course, if you don't know, that was a nickname given to Alfred Hitchcock. The scenes in this are actually pretty intense and mind-blowing, and this story is actually a lot more decent for a sequel than it should be. Anthony Perkins, of course, returns as Norman Bates, and he does an excellent, just as good of, just as excellent as of a job as he did in the first cycle. And the rest of the cast does a pretty good job as well. This had a budget of $5 million and brought in $34.7 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 6.5 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 60%, Letterboxd a 3 out of 5, and I give it a 3.8 out of 5. Next up is 1986's Psycho 3.
Just wants to be left alone in peace.
Aren't you going to take him in for questioning or anything?
Just leave him alone.
Norman Bates is back to normal. But Mother's off her rocker. Again.
Norman, is that you?
Yes, Mother. It's me.
Bates Motel.
Aside from total boredom, nothing's going to happen to you here.
Well, I can't have that sort of thing going on in my motel. Gives the place a bad name.
Why are you so kind to me?
You remind me of someone.
Mother! I figured Bates was a geek, but a full-fledged Looney Tune?
Norman!
I'll get you for this, Mother.
You haven't got the guts, boy!
It's 1982 and Norman Bates is working at the Bates Motel and lives with the preserved corpse of Emma Spool, a waitress who told him she was his real mother. When Spool remains missing after a month, Norman's ex-boss, Ralph Statler, and the local enforcement grow concerned. Dwayne Duke, a sleazy musician desperate for money, is offered the job of assistant manager at the motel. Tracy Venable, a journalist from Los Angeles, is working on an article about serial killers being released from custody, and believing that Norman is killing again, Tracy appears at the diner where he works and attempts to talk with him. Norman opens up to her, but is distracted when Maureen Coyle, a young, mentally unstable former nun, enters. Maureen resembles his former victim, Marion Crane, and seeing initials MC on her suitcase, Norman panics and leaves the diner. Mother then enters Maureen's bathroom that night, intending to kill her, only to find that she has cut her own wrist. The shock of this causes Norman to reassert his personality while a delirious Maureen mistakes Mother holding a knife for the Virgin Mary holding a crucifix. Norman then brings Maureen to a hospital and offers that she stay as long as she needs to, and after she's released, they begin a romantic relationship. That night, Duke picks up a girl named Red at the bar, but after Red makes it clear that she wants more than a fling, Duke rejects her, and Red tries calling a cab, but Mother shatters the phone booth door and stabs Red to death. The following day, tourists arrive at the motel, planning to watch a football game, and Tracy searches Spool's apartment, discovering the motel's phone number written on a magazine cover repeatedly. Patsy Boyle, the motel's only sober guest, is murdered by Mother, and Norman finds her body and buries her in the motel's ice chest. The next morning, Sheriff Hunt and Deputy Leo appear to investigate Patty's disappearance, and Tracy tells Maureen about Norman's past, causing Maureen to stay with Father Brian, who took care of her at the hospital. Norman finds that Spool's corpse is missing and finds a note saying that she's in cabin 12, and Duke extorts Norman, threatening to turn him into the police for murder unless he is given a large sum of money. In the ensuing fight, Norman beats Duke with his guitar until he loses consciousness, and Norman then drives his car to the swamp with Duke and Patsy's bodies inside. Duke regains consciousness and attacks Norman, who accidentally drives into the swamp, and Norman escapes the car while Duke drowns. Tracy then talks to Statler about Spool and discovers she was working at the diner before Statler purchased it from Harvey Leach. Tracy meets with Leach, a resident at an assisted living facility, and is informed that Spool was also institutionalized for murder. Maureen convinces herself that Norman is her true love and returns to the motel, and they share a tender moment at the top of the staircase when Mother shouts fiercely at Norman, startling him. He loses his grip on Maureen's hands, causing her to fall down the stairs, which kills her. Enraged, Norman promises Mother that he will get her for this, and Tracy enters the house and finds Maureen dead, then sees Norman dressed as Mother, carrying a knife, but is unable to flee. Tracy then tries to reason with Norman by explaining his family history, that Emma Spool was his aunt and was in love with Norman's father, but he married his sister Norma. Spool killed Norman's father and kidnapped Norman when he was a child, believing he was the child she should have had with him. When she was caught, Norman was returned to Norma while Spool was institutionalized. Tracy discovered Spool's corpse in the bedroom, and Norman takes off his dress. Mother orders him to kill Tracy, but when Norman raises a knife, he attacks Mother instead, dismembering Spool's corpse. Sheriff Hunt then takes Norman to his squad car, and Hunt informs Norman that he'll never get out of the institution again, to which Norman replies, "But I'll be free. I'll finally be free." And in the back of the squad car, Norman caresses the severed hand of Emma Spool as the movie ends. One of my biggest problems with this movie is that some of the dialogue is pretty fucking cheesy and rambles, especially when it comes to Norman. And Norman's dialogue is also pretty repetitive, pretty much repeating the same things over and over again, unlike the other two movies. I mean, it certainly could have been better. The nudity was overused and pretty gratuitous, even though while there's nothing wrong with that, it gets kind of stupid after a while. And there is some gore, but it's handled pretty tastefully. And this was, of course, directed by Norman Bates himself, Anthony Perkins. I believe this was his first time directing a movie. It's not... His directing style isn't anything mind-blowing. It's definitely not Hitchcock. But it's suitable enough for this movie. But there is also things to like about this. You know, like I said, Perkins plays Norman perfectly, as always. And the rest of the cast does a pretty good job as well. And the story is decent enough for being a second sequel. This had a budget of $8.4 million and brought in $14.4 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 5.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes is 61%. Letterboxd, 3 out of 5. And I give it a 3 out of 5 as well. And that brings us to the final film. Or the original. Or the final film in the original series. Psycho, or 1990s Psycho 4. The beginning.
60. Alfred Hitchcock created a film that is perhaps the most terrifying thriller of all time. Psycho. Now come answers to the questions audiences have been asking for over 30 years. Psycho 4. The beginning.
This is Fran Ambrose on KTK Talk of the Town.
I call because the focus of your show tonight is what makes boys kill their mothers.
Are you saying you killed your mother?
I killed some other women, too.
You want to tell us about your mother, how she drove you to become what you became?
She'd be sweet one moment, and then she'd suddenly turn mean. Don't you have any respect for the dead?
How did it all start?
What are you doing here?
Shh. We're gonna wake up your mother.
Kill her.
I can't, no.
Then I'll do it for you.
What makes Norman Bates kill?
Look at yourself, boy. Ha, girl. Yes, girl. No. Mama's little girl. No.
How'd you kill your mother?
Slowly.
This be the end of Norman Bates.
Oh, I've killed before. And now I'm gonna have to do it again.
Or is it only the beginning? Psycho 4, The Beginning. Anthony Perkins stars with Olivia Hussey, CCH Pounder, and Henry Thomas as young Norman Bates. Psycho 4, The Beginning on video cassette.
A once again rehabilitated Norman Bates is now married to a psychiatrist named Connie and is expecting a child. Norman secretly fears that the child will inherit his mental illness, and one evening he hears radio talk show host Fran Ambrose discussing the topic of matricide with their guest, Dr. Richmond, Norman's former psychologist. Norman then calls into the radio show using the alias Ed to tell his story. Norman's narrative is seen as a series of flashbacks set in the 1940s and 1950s. Some seem like they're kind of out of order for some fucking reason, I don't really know. But anyway, when Norman is 6 years old, his father dies, leaving him in the care of his mother, Norma. Over the years, Norma, who is implied to suffer from schizophrenia and borderline personality disorder, dominates her son, beating him for even the smallest infraction on a regular basis, throwing him out in the rain when naked, teaching him that sex is sinful, dressing him in girls' clothes and lipstick as punishment for getting an erection during potentially, it's pretty incestuous foreplay that Norma herself initiates. She also takes her frustration out on Norman when business at the motel fails due to the new interstate routing potential customers away from their location. The two live in isolation until in 1949, she becomes engaged to a brutish man named Chet Rudolph. Driven over the edge with jealousy and sick of Chet's constant abuse, all of which Norman encourages, Norman kills both of them by serving them poisoned iced tea. He then disposes of Chet's body before stealing and preserving his mother's corpse, and he develops a split personality in which he becomes his mother to suppress the guilt of murdering her. Whenever this personality takes over, it drives him to dress in his mother's clothes, put on a wig, and talk to himself in her voice. As mother, he murders two local women who try to seduce him during their stay at his newly opened motel. After these and other killings, Norman appears to have no recollection of committing the murders himself and believes mother is alone responsible. We then fast forward to the present day, where Dr. Richmond realizes Ed is Norman and tries to convince Ambrose to trace the calls. Richmond's worries are dismissed, and Norman fears he will go insane and kill again. He tells Fran that Connie got pregnant against his wishes and that he does not want to create another monster. He then tells Fran he realizes that his mother is dead, but he fears that his mother may repossess him and kill Connie with my own hands, just like the first time. Norman then takes his wife to his mother's house, but Connie reminds Norman that it was his own choice to go insane and do the things he did, reassuring Norman that the child will not be a monster with their guidance, and he realizes the truth to having freedom of choice, and he drops his knife. Finally, Norman impulsively sets fire to the house where all his unhappiness began. And as he tries to escape the flames, he hallucinates that he sees his victims, his mother, and eventually himself preserving her corpse. And Norman runs from the burning house alive. He and Connie then leave the next day, and Norman happily proclaims, "I'm free," indicating that his mother will never again haunt his mind and drive him insane. Then the wooden doors of the house cellar close on a rocking chair that continues to rock, at which point Mother screams, even breaking down crying, for Norman to release her before the scene cuts to black and the sound of a baby crying is heard. This is pretty much a made-for-TV movie, and it shows. It's not anywhere near as good or at least decent as the previous three movies were. And you can tell, like I said, that it was definitely made for TV just from the lack of gore and kind of like the, I guess the best word to describe it is a dumbing down of Norman's crimes or previous crimes. And it's just not, there's just something missing from this. I mean, I guess for a TV movie, it's all right, but it's really not that good. And if you just skipped this and watched the other three movies, you wouldn't really be missing out on anything. It's just all right for what it is. IMDb gave it a 5.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, 45%. Letterboxd, again, 3 out of 5. And I give it a 2 out of 5. And in 1998, there was a reboot made starring Vince Vaughn and Anne Heche. And I'm not even going to bother talking about it because it's pretty much a shot-for-shot remake of the first 1960 film. But it's just done pretty fucking poorly, and it's a stupid fucking movie. Even though, like I said, it's a shot-for-shot remake, pretty much of the first movie. It's just, like I said, it's just done not very well. I mean, it's pretty much a waste of time, so don't even bother with it. There was also a TV series, Bates Motel, that ran for five seasons beginning in 2013. And I guess you could also call it kind of, well, it is a prequel. And the show was pretty popular. And I saw the first two seasons, I think it was, before I kind of got tired of it. And from the seasons I saw, it was a decent enough show. I'm sure if you're listening to this, you've probably seen that series. And it's definitely worth the watch if you come across it. And I was going to end this episode there, but I guess you're going to kind of get a bonus two-in-one, or two-for-one episode, because I decided to talk about another franchise that had a shitty reboot, but features basically a psychopathic killer posing underneath a mask of normalcy. And that was the Stepfather franchise, which started in 1987 with The Stepfather.
Dear Lord, we thank you for our dear friends, our wonderful home. But most of all, Father, we thank you for bringing us together as a family. Amen.
Amen.
When I came here, I was a stranger. But I've never felt more at home anywhere in my life. I have beautiful friends. I have a wonderful new family. This is as good as it gets.
You never talk about your past. Past is important.
It didn't even exist until I met you.
Hi, honey.
That's my girl.
We have to talk, honey.
About what?
About what is happening to our family.
I'm taking care of it.
It isn't our house anymore. It's his. There's just something about him. He scares me. I'm afraid of him.
He's your father now, and you'll respect him.
He's not my father. He's just some crazy creep.
I don't think we have to break up the family, do we, Pumpkin?
It's okay, sweetheart. I won't hurt you.
Come out here now! Get out here!
It's all a game, Steph, huh? Ollie Ollie home free.
Loosely based on the life of mass murderer John List, the movie involves Henry Morrison assuming a different identity in the attempt to find the perfect family. In the beginning of the movie, he is seen in the bathroom washing off the blood after murdering the family he'd been living with, and as he comes down the stairs from upstairs, there's actually a pretty, you don't see very much, but it's actually a pretty disturbing scene where the bodies are of the family that he had been living with, I guess is the best way to put it, strewn across around the room, and there's bloody handprints, and it's quite obvious that some of the victims were children. It's actually, like I said, it's probably one of the most disturbing scenes in this movie, even though you really don't see all that much. Henry then changes his appearance and puts his belongings into a suitcase and leaves through the front door of his house, like I said, nonchalantly passing the butchered remains of his family. Then, getting on a boat, Henry throws a suitcase containing objects from his former life into the ocean. 1 year later, Henry, now operating as a real estate agent named Jerry Blake in the suburbs of Seattle, has married the widow, Susan Main. Jerry's relationship with Susan's 16-year-old daughter, Stephanie, is strained to say the least, and her psychiatrist, Dr. Bondrant, advises her to give Jerry a chance. Stephanie, meanwhile, has a lot of behavioral issues at school and is skeptical of Jerry and his intentions. Meanwhile, Jim Ogilvie, the brother of Jerry's murdered previous wife, runs an article about his sister's murder in the newspaper and attempts to find the man that killed his sister. While hosting a neighborhood barbecue, Jerry discovers the article and is disturbed by it. He then goes into the basement of the house and begins maniacally rambling to himself, unaware that Stephanie has also entered the basement. Seeing his stepdaughter, Jerry brushes off his outburst by saying that he was simply letting off some steam, and he tells her not to worry. Stephanie then finds a newspaper mentioning Jerry's earlier killings and comes to believe that her stepfather is the murderer mentioned in the article. She then writes a letter to the newspaper requesting a photo of Henry Morrison, but Jerry finds the photo in the mail and replaces it with the stranger's photo, making her believe that it's somebody else other than Jerry. Curious about Stephanie's stepfather, who has repeatedly refused to meet him, Dr. Bondurin makes an appointment with Jerry under an assumed name, saying he wants to buy a house. During their meeting, Bondurin asks too many personal questions, and Jerry realizes that Bondurin is not who he says he is, and mistakenly believing he is an undercover cop, beats him to death and puts him in Bondurin's car. He then sets the car on fire, and the next day, Jerry informs Stephanie of Bondurin's death, claiming he was in a car accident, and succeeds in bonding with her. Jerry's newfound relationship with his stepdaughter is quickly cut short, however, when he catches Stephanie kissing her boyfriend, Paul. Jerry then accuses Paul of attempting to rape Stephanie, which causes an argument with Stephanie and Susan, and drives Paul away. Stephanie runs out on Jerry and Susan because Susan says Jerry is her father, even though he's not. The next day, Jerry then quits his job and creates a whole new identity for himself in another town. And he begins to go after another widow while planning to get rid of Susan and Stephanie. Having discovered where Jerry is now living, Jim begins going door to door in search of his former brother-in-law. And after Jim stops by, Susan phones the real estate agency to tell Jerry that someone's looking for him, only to be informed that Jerry quit several days ago. Susan then asks Jerry, but while explaining himself to Susan, Jerry confuses his identity, and Susan realizes Stephanie was right about him, because Jerry basically goes into a little rant, and like I said, he trips up over, you know, his identities, and he says, "Who am I?" to Susan, and that's, of course, when she freaks out. But realizing his mistake, Jerry bashes Susan on the head with the phone and knocks her down the basement stairs. And content that Susan is dead, Jerry then sets out to kill Stephanie. Jim, who has realized Jerry is a man who killed his family, arrives wielding a revolver, but Jerry stabs him to death before Jim can shoot. And after terrorizing Stephanie, he corners her in the attic, only to fall through the weak floor down to the bathroom. Susan then shoots Jerry twice when he tries to attack Stephanie, and Stephanie stabs him in the chest. He weakly utters, "I love you," and tumbles back down the stairs. And Stephanie later cuts down a birdhouse that she and Jerry had built during the time they bonded, and the movie ends. Probably the first film out of the franchise. This moves along at a good pace, and it has ample amount of tension, suspense, and creepiness. I mean, it's slightly darkly comical as well, especially when Jerry has his little freakouts. And Jerry is played very well by Terry O'Quinn, who some people may recognize from Lost. And he plays Jerry pretty creepily. It's just a very good movie, in my opinion, at least. And it's definitely worth a watch. IMDb gave it a 6.7 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes an 88%. Letterboxd a 3.5 out of 5, and I give it a 4 out of 5. And that leads us into 1989's Stepfather 2.
Jerry Blake, Henry Morrison, and before them Bill Crager, they all had something in common. They were all for a time happily married, and they were all same man. What kind of man changes names like other people change their clothes? Where do your thoughts take you?
There was an accident, kinda.
Just about anything that you'd want in a kitchen has been built in.
Well,
my last house had a basement workshop. I like to work with my hands.
Do you specialize in your practice, Gene?
Family guidance types of problems.
Where do your thoughts take you?
Phil left a little over a year ago.
He's zeroing in on you, and he's ignoring everybody else. Dr. Gene Clifford, this is...
Phil. Phil Grayland, Carol's husband. Why is he here?
Oh, he wants a second chance.
Why don't you ask Phil to stop by and have a chat with me tonight? I think it's time I cracked open this file.
Carol, what exactly do you know about Gene?
Is that nothing? Make room for Daddy.
How do I know he won't come back again? For no one in the fiddly.
Come on, Maddie.
You don't even know if he's a real shrimp.
You're nothing!
Who the hell are you?
Would you let me tell her?
What are you going to tell her? More lies?
Carol, I have a confession to make.
She's agreed to become my wife.
You will never find a better family. There's something that you should know about my past.
Stepfather 2. Daddy is back.
After being shot twice and stabbed in the chest at the end of the previous film, Jerry Blake, once again played by Terry O'Quinn, is institutionalized in Puget Sound, Washington. Blake has meetings with the psychiatrist, and having gained his trust, he kills the psychiatrist and the guard. He then dons the guard's uniform to help him escape, and arriving at a train depot, Blake kills and robs a traveling salesman for his car and money. Blake then checks in a hotel, alters his appearance, and assumes the identity of deceased publisher Gene F. Clifford, and travels to Palm Meadows, Los Angeles. In Palm Meadows, Gene poses as a psychiatrist and soon meets Carol Grayland and leases a house across the street from her and her 13-year-old son, Todd. During a session with the neighborhood wives, Gene learns that Carol's husband, Philip, left his family the previous year. By the way, Jerry is now going underneath the name Gene, who it was a deceased publisher whose identity he basically stole. I don't remember if I had mentioned that earlier. But anyway, during a session with the neighborhood wives, Gene learns that Carol's husband, Philip, left his... I've said this. But Phil returns, wanting to reconcile with his wife. Needing Phil out of the way, Gene persuades Carol to send him over for a meeting, during which Gene smashes a bottle on his head and then stabs him to death. He covers up Phil's disappearance afterwards by making it look like he simply ran off again, and with Phil gone, Gene and Carol arrange to get married. Maddie Crimmins, local mail carrier and Carol's best friend, becomes suspicious of Gene and begins looking through Gene's mail. She finds a letter addressed to the real Gene Clifford, which includes a photograph revealing him to be African American, and she confronts Gene, demanding to know who he really is. Gene then persuades her to let him tell Carol the truth about his past, and later that night, after fucking Carol, Gene sneaks into Maddie's house and strangles her to death, making her death look like a suicide. On his way out, Gene takes Maddie's last bottle of wine and crosses through the yard of Maddie's blind neighbor Sam Watkins, who hears Gene whistling Camptown Races, which he mentions to Carol the next day. Despite Maddie's death, the wedding proceeds as planned, and while dressing in the church, Carol recognizes bottles of wine sent by Maddie's parents as the same brand Gene had the other night, and overhears Todd whistling Camptown Races, which he says Gene taught him. Thinking Gene may have had something to do with Maddie's death, Carol confronts him, prompting Gene to attack Carol and Todd, whom he locks in a storage closet. As Gene prepares to kill Carol with the knife she used to stab him, Todd breaks out of the closet and saves his mother, knocking the knife out of Gene's hand and stabbing him in the chest with the claw hammer, apparently killing him. As Carol and Todd walk into the wedding ceremony, everyone is shocked to see them covered in blood until Carol collapses on the floor. The film then ends with Gene getting up, stumbling through the room for the wedding party, and collapsing on the floor by the destroyed wedding cake, weakly uttering, "Till death." then seemingly dying from his wounds. This was a movie that really didn't need to exist. But bringing Terry O'Quinn back is a huge plus, and he's pretty much pitch perfect here. He's joined by Meg Foster, who is equally as game, and who is there. How am I trying to say this? She's game to throw herself into a pretty ridiculous story. There's also a nice dose of playful dark humor throughout, and the murder set pieces will please gore fiends without turning off those in the mood for more traditional thriller stylings. And I truly can't fucking talk today, I'm sorry. But anyway, like I said, it doesn't fall into the usual curse of sequels in the sense that it's better than most, but it's still not a super great movie. And it's definitely not as good as the first one. IMDb gave it a 5.6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, a 25%. Letterboxd, a 2.8 out of 5. And I give it a solid 3 out of 5. And that brings us to the conclusion of the Stepfather trilogy, 1992's Stepfather 3.
In a perfect community, a perfect mom.
I love you very much, Henry.
Can meet a perfect stranger.
You found us.
I sure did.
She knows what she wants.
Oh, I want to make love to you.
She knows what she feels.
I do.
But what she doesn't know.
You are the most incredible man I have ever known.
Could kill her.
Authorities have finally come up with their first solid lead on the escaped family's serial killer.
What are those scars behind your ears?
You're gonna look like a new man. Different but quite normal.
Authorities believe the wanted killer had plastic surgery and then murdered the physician at least 9 months ago.
I want to find out who my stepfather really is.
Now you're taking this too far. It's gotta stop right now.
You have no idea how important my family is to me.
Here's the most recent photograph of the family serial killer. He's considered extremely dangerous.
I know what's going on, you know.
Silence is golden, Mr. Thompson.
In a mind of madness.
This is your home. I am your daddy.
There is no right.
Has he ever hurt you?
There is no wrong.
You just can't break up the family.
There is no mercy. Tradition continues.
Sleep tight. Daddy needs a family.
Don't let the bedbugs bite.
I'm not going to spend too much talking about this because it's a fucking piece of shit. It's another made-for-TV movie, and it doesn't even feature Terry O'Quinn, who saw how stupid this fucking script for this probably was. And said, fuck this, I'm not doing this. But even it's basically involves the same stepfather from the first two movies, even though this time he has had his face surgically altered so he doesn't resemble the person that he was, and also so they can explain why Terry O'Quinn didn't even bother to return for this, even though. And like I said before in the previous film, it's quite obvious that Jerry/Gene died from his wounds at the end of the previous film. But he somehow survived and escapes once again from the insane asylum and has his face surgically altered and gets married again, this time to a woman with a child in a wheelchair, and he goes on a killing spree once again. Blah, blah, blah. If you've seen the previous two films, you should be pretty familiar with how the formula for this one is going to go. This time, Jerry, who's going under the name Grant, kills anyone who threatens to spoil his plans before turning his murderous intentions to his new wife. But surprisingly, especially for a 1992 TV movie, the kills in this are actually gorier than they were in the bigger budgeted big screen movies, which is pretty fucking weird, but they are. But it's still a very tired formula, and it doesn't lack any magic or any suspense like the previous two films did. IMDb gave it a 4.6 out of 10. It didn't even chart on Rotten Tomatoes. Letterboxd gave it a 2.3 out of 5. And I give it a 1.5 out of 5. And that's me being nice. This, of course, led to a 2009 reboot starring Dylan McDermott. And once again, I'm not even going to fucking bother talking about it because it's a very fucking stupid remake. And it never should have been made. It pretty much shits and pisses all over the original. And it just makes it a very generic slasher film. And it's just stupid. It's not even ever worth watching. And that just about wraps it up for me today, guys. As always, you can reach out to me at DARKSYDE 9034 at gmail.com. And next episode, Animus Morgue 666 will once again be returning to co-host with me. We're planning on doing that next weekend, and I'll get that out as soon as we're done recording it. Who knows, maybe we'll go longer than fucking 3.5 hours like we did last time. I guess we'll just wait and find out, and you'll have to wait and find out to see what we talk about next time. So I'll see you guys then. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tunes of Horror.